Moin, moin, liebe Leute, hier spricht Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und wie eine echte Feministin kann ich natürlich nicht kochen. Naja, nicht ganz. Ich mag kochen, aber das Ganze drumherum strengt mich an. Was koche ich heute und wieder neue Rezepte ausdenken und dann noch in den Supermarkt. Das Gute bei HelloFresh ist, dass du da jede Woche aus über 40 super Rezepten dir etwas aussuchen kannst und du kriegst alles so geliefert, wie du es brauchst. Und mit meinem Code FRESH24 könnt ihr in Deutschland bis zu 120 Euro sparen. Der Code ist für neue und ehemalige Kundinnen gültig. Testet es nochmal mit meinem Code FRESH24.
On DSTV Channel 885
and across the city
on 567 AM.
Okay, class, time to sit down and take a listen to the very many questions in already, and it's questions for a lecturer at the University of Cambridge, Dr. Chris Smith, and funny known to us as the Naked Scientist. He joins us via Zoom once more to answer a variety of science, medical, and other questions I've noted that have come through. Welcome, Dr. Chris Smith. Always good to have you on a Friday.
Good to talk to you, Clarence. Good morning.
We're going to jump right in. It's a question about obsessive compulsive disorder. It reads, do medications actually work? Why is there no cure for OCD? Psychiatrists give medication. Psychologists will have therapy sessions and do ERP, which is hectic as you face and feel the fear. I have read that the medical professional scientists are researching a pacemaker for the brain. Can you please give any more information if it will rid us of OCD forever? Will it take the compulsions away and the intrusive thoughts away? It is hell on earth. Gail is reaching out.
Morning, Gail. And in that question, really I highlighted some of the key aspects of the problems that are confronted by people who have this. It sounds, and it's often very trivialised in the media. People say OCD or, you know, that's my OCD kicking in. And we use it almost as a throwaway thing to say. But for people who are affected, it's really, really serious. Let me give you an example. Some people who have this cannot leave the house in the morning without checking that they have locked the door and unlocked the door about 15 times, having washed their hands because of a fear of contagion, and then sometimes got dressed and undressed several times. The reason that it takes them 3 hours to leave home, by which time they're feeling utterly stressed and demoralised and depressed and tired before they've even got on the bus to go to work, is because of an irrational fear that if they don't go through these rituals, something awful is going to happen. So if you imagine how that feels to you, you get up in the morning and you have this dread descending on you that something will happen unless you follow the rules set down by whatever your obsession and compulsions dictate. And if you don't do that, or if there's a slight chance you might have made a mistake and didn't do that, then something awful is going to happen. Someone you love, something awful will happen to them, something awful will happen to things you treasure, etc. We don't know why this happens to some people, but it's very common. A proportion, probably one person in 100 in the population to one in 50 in the population has this, some to a greater extent, some to a lesser extent. Some people can manage this and you don't know they have a problem and they're very good at finding ways for it not to be too intrusive on their life. Others, it's completely disabling and it destroys their quality of life. And it can get worse over time to the extent that people almost can't leave the house because to do all of these rituals and things takes so long that that's what they're compelled to do by these beliefs that it's exhausting and they think, I'm just going to withdraw from society and I'll stay at home because it's easier. So it is a very serious problem and it does run in families. And if you have people who have it in your family, in a first degree relative, you're more likely to have this yourself. We believe that it's connected to a particular part of the brain concerned with how we do rationalize things and how we decide what to do and how we make judgments about risk and that kind of thing. And unsurprisingly, drugs that are targeted at that part of the brain can give some people some relief. So some of the major antipsychotics, the antidepressant drugs, there are particular classes of those that do give people some relief, some of the serotonin targeting drugs. And as Gail asks, there are also interventions now where people are having deep brain stimulation, where electrodes can be placed in certain parts of the brain and they act almost like a metronome. And they can alter the activity of certain brain areas, which we know project to or have influence upon the parts of the brain we think are affected in this condition. And they modulate that brain area. And by tuning the beating of that metronome, you can achieve a modulation or a control over the affected brain area, which helps to reduce the symptoms. So through a combination of helping people behaviourally, that's where the cognitive therapy comes in, and you always start with the simple stuff first, and then if that doesn't work or it's not good enough, you progress on to let's try some pharmaceuticals, some pharmacological interventions, and see if that can help. And sometimes a combination of the two is enough, and if that doesn't help, you can go a step further, and there are these other interventions that are coming on track now to help people that little bit more. But it's not to be trivialized. It's a very serious problem, and it does drive some people to be so upset by this that they even consider taking their life. So if a person's in that position, please, please, please do get help for this, because A, there are lots of people who have it, so you're certainly not on your own. So everyone will take this very seriously, and there are lots of ways to deal with it, which will enormously increase your quality of life.
Gail, I hope that helps. Jenny's on the line. Jenny in Cormorchy, you've got a question for the Naked Scientist.
Yes, hi, Karen. Thank you. And hi, Dr. Smith.
Good morning.
Obviously, we all scratch an itch. But why, when we are faced with something we can't comprehend mentally, like trying to understand that the weight of a marble size of a dwarf planet being so heavy that it will fall right through the earth, why then do we scratch our heads? Is it just a form of distraction?
Not everyone does, Jen. Some people scratch their head. Some people stick their tongue out. Really interesting. I've watched some of my colleagues at work when they're on the phone, when they're concentrating, they're trying to compile a particularly sensitive email to that prickly member of staff that we know will have a hair trigger and react the wrong way if we put one word wrong. Those kind of things. You'll see them stick their tongue out and clench it between their teeth. Some people furrow their brow. I think probably it's a range of things, but what we're doing when we're considering, contemplating, building mental imagery inside our heads, what we're doing is taking the world outside and building a picture inside. And sometimes that involves putting yourself into the shoes of another person. So sometimes you're almost superimposing them on your own brain to work out how they must be feeling or what they would do if. Sometimes we find ourselves almost acting out a scenario by moving our hands around, that kind of thing. So I think part of this is that we are creating that mental picture that helps the thought process. Sometimes it is to do with the fact that you develop almost a ritual where if you tap your fingers, then you are helping your brain to describe a certain rhythm or think in a certain way. Sometimes by doing something with some part of your body, you remove it from distracting you. You stop yourself from distracting yourself, almost. So I think it's a range of different factors, but it's not universal. Everyone will scratch their head. I think that was a product of a cartoon, and people, you know, the Disney cartoons where the cartoon character sort of has two fingers, their index finger and the one next door, and they put it on top of their head and go scratch, scratch, scratch when they're really confused. And I think it's become a sort of meme. I don't think it's universal that that's all we do. I think people have a range of different stereotypical behaviours when they are thinking.
And a great question, Jen. Thank you for it. Somebody wants to know why we have accents.
Well, it's learned behavior. Humans are a social species, and we learn from each other, and we fit in and work together. And without each other, we are not half as good as we are when we're in a big group. And the way we bond with each other, the way we learn, exchange information, and form social cohesion is that we behave like each other. It's an empathetic thing where I mirror your behavior, and that shows you that I think you're worth and I value you to the extent that I want to copy you. Imitation's the highest form of flattery. And so it shows that we're part of the same group, part of the same kin. We're working together, and therefore we learn to sound like each other because we learn our speech from those around us. And because certain sounds get exaggerated in certain groups and certain ways of speaking, children pick those up and incorporate them into their pattern of speaking, as do adults, but it's more common in children. So we end up with a group who all sound the same. And this was much more pronounced historically because the world was a much less well-connected place. When people went from one place to another, they tended to stay there because, let's face it, it was a long way on horseback and a long perilous journey to go anywhere else. So you tended to get communities that became quite geographically and quite socially isolated and stayed together. So certain behaviours concentrated in those particular groups, in those particular geographies. And it's in the more modern era where people watch TV imported from all over the world. They listen to radio programs and blokes from the other side of the planet talking in different accents. And we're diluting some of this out now more because people are more connected and more mobile. But because we're very strongly influenced by what happens to us most of the time, we're still seeing quite a strong concentration of these behaviours locally, although they are diluting. And someone did a study about 20 years ago where they looked at people from Scotland and a particular part of Glasgow, one of the big cities in Scotland, that had a particularly Glaswegian way of saying certain words. And they looked at how older people and younger people in communities there were saying those words and how that was changing over time. And they found that as those people were being exposed to, or they speculated that because these people were being exposed to a lot of television, having accents used by people from London, that the Glaswegians and the young who were more exposed to those programmes than the older people were tending to adopt those London ways of saying some of the words and losing the Glaswegian way of saying the words. So that sort of speaks to the point I'm trying to make, that modern media is diluting some of these effects, but that's they're still sad. Pretty powerful.
That's sad, though. But, yeah, there's a couple of voice notes. Let's go to one of them, Joe. Thank you.
Morning, Clarence and Dr. Smith. I have a question. There's a thing, or I've heard about the devil's hour, which is roughly between 3 and 4 a.m. And apparently there's a lot of proof and scientific evidence on why people wake up at this time. And some nights I sleep through, but a lot of the times from 3:30, 4 o'clock, start stirring and thinking silly things. Otherwise, thanks to Lekker Show, Steve Brockenfell.
Well, why do we wake early? Well, one of the reasons we wake up at all is because the brain releases a massive surge of the hormone cortisol from our adrenal glands in the early hours of the morning. And it does this because this hormone, which goes round in the bloodstream and it visits every cell in the body via the bloodstream, winds up your metabolism. Cranks up metabolism. It's a stress hormone which pushes up sugar levels and gets us ready for the day ahead. Now, when that surge happens, it's starting the wake-up process. Now, if you wake up around that time, or something has disrupted your cortisol levels, so you produce more cortisol than you should, and this can happen with chronic stress and anxiety and depression. It can also happen if you take the drugs, because you can take these things artificially, or because you are jet lagged and so that surge is happening at the wrong time, your wake-up signal might be coming a bit early. So instead of it starting around that time to get you ready to get up at 7 o'clock, if it starts a bit before it should, then it's waking you up a bit too early. And classically, people who do have a lot of mental illnesses, particularly people with depression, do say they'll wake up around that time, probably because they're getting a big surge in cortisol a bit too early in the night and it's a bit too high, and it gets them up, gets them awake, and then they can't go back to sleep. And then you tend to sit there with nothing else to do because it's dark and quiet. So you think about yourself, you think about the things that are worrying you, and they go round like a washing machine, building up the intensity of the anxiety and making you even more stressed. And then because you feel tired during the day, you don't perform very well. And because you don't perform very well, you feel even more stressed. And then you feel really exhausted. You go to bed early because you think, I'm so tired, I'm going to go to bed. You go to bed early and then you wake up early the next day because this happened. And you can see how it goes round and round like a vicious cycle. So the key thing is good sleep hygiene. Get yourself to bed at the same time. Try and de-stress yourself, sleep in a relatively unstressed environment as much as you can. And when you do have a problem like that and you wake up, don't ruminate on bad things. Think about good things or find a way to distract yourself, break the state, get up, do something else, then go back to bed and you'll find you often go back to sleep.
Zelt has a question for you, the Naked Scientist, through to 10 o'clock. It reads, is it true that cancer cannot exist without sugar?
It's certainly true that cancer can exist without sugar. I've not heard anyone say that cancer is absolutely dependent on sugar. I'm not sure quite where that comes from. Cancer is a genetic disease, and we are more likely to get cancer as we get older because as we age, we accumulate damage to the genes that are encoded by our DNA, and this includes damage to the genes that repair DNA. So if you damage the genes that repair your DNA, you increase the likelihood of getting more damage more often in other places. Eventually, this causes cells to begin to grow out of control, grow too fast, disobey the normal messages that would make them remove themselves or kill themselves at the end of their lives, stay put, not grow invasively, not secrete the wrong sorts of messages. Cancers, therefore, are genetic problems, and they are metabolically very active, and they can use all kinds of different substances that we get our energy from in the body. They're not just dependent on sugar, but some cancers will be because of the nature of the beast, but not all. And you can never say never in medicine.
Never say never in medicine. Let's go to a voice note, Joe.
Dr. Chris, I experienced post nasal drip, and then what happens is that I'll get blockage from my throat, and then a lot of mucus build up as well, especially at night and in the morning. And then what happens is that when I drink cold drinks or sodas that have sweetness, so it creates a reflex for me, like the sweetener taste is left on my throat for quite some time, to up to 24 hours at a time, and then it doesn't really get better. So I only drink full sugar drinks. Is that what's the reason that might be causing that?
Well, it sounds like there might be some, and I think he mentions reflux. And this is really common. When we swallow stuff, it goes down our esophagus, the food pipe, and into the stomach. And it goes through a sphincter at the bottom of the esophagus that separates the bottom of the esophagus from the stomach. And the role of that sphincter is to keep the stomach contents in the stomach and not allow it to come back up. But in some people, and it's pretty common, you can get a weakness in that sphincter, which allows some of the stomach contents to splash back up the esophagus. And this can produce a range of different consequences, including reflux sensations and acid and brackish tastes in the back of the mouth. It can also, in the long term, cause ulceration in the esophagus. And it's important to investigate this and keep an eye on it because it can have other consequences. And it can be produced because of a problem called a hiatus hernia. If you have a sliding hiatus hernia, this is where the esophagus moves and the junction with the stomach move up and down through the diaphragm, and it can make it more likely to leak in this sort of way. Sweeteners are not broken down in the body very quickly, and then certainly not absorbed and used like normal sugars are. And so it's unsurprising if there is reflux happening that you might taste that sweetness. If you've got stuff bubbling back up your esophagus from your stomach, it will carry sweeteners from things like fizzy drinks back up, and they get into the back of the throat and the mouth and the tongue at low concentration, but they're very potent. And so you'll taste the sweetness that was there again because those chemicals haven't disappeared, because they may take a long while to break down. Some of them don't break down at all. They just get weed out of the body. Others do break down, but quite slowly in the body into other metabolites. And so I suspect that's what's going on. But if this is a chronic thing, it's definitely worth getting this checked out, because you A, want to make sure there's nothing amiss that can't be fixed, and B, you also want to make sure you try and get some relief, because it can't be very nice having this sort of thing going on all the time.
We were talking about race a little earlier, so I understand this particular question. Is there such a thing as multiple races on planet Earth, Dr. Smith?
I don't really understand, because the people who are specialists in this have certain interpretations of what all these words mean, and I'm not a specialist in this. So if I say all the wrong things, then people will probably kill me and send me hate mail and all that kind of thing. So put that to one side. What I'm going to say is based on my limited knowledge of what these words mean. And if I get it wrong, tough. Let's all grow some, you know, and be sensible about this. We're not trying to offend anybody. We just don't have all the same speak and language that some people do. Do I sound cynical and like I've been on the wrong end of some people with an agenda in the past? Sorry if I do. The answer is, of course, there are different races around the world. There are lots of different types of people who've evolved over time in different geographies. And geography, in the same way as it's selected for accents, has selected for certain physical and genetic traits. And this is because when we evolved, we think we evolved on the African continent. We think that happened over the last X number of million years and slowly distilled out the species that is us. That those groups of organ or those individuals left Africa probably in the last 100,000 years or so. People dispute this. They're not quite, the evidence is not 100% clear, but it looks like it's sometime between 50 and 100,000 years ago, and then peopled the Earth. And there were various waves of migration that went across the planet, following the geography, following the terrain, following the conditions, where there was food, where there were good places to live, where there wasn't a hostile environment. People went. And as they went, they were selected. And by that we mean that there would have been some harsh winters that meant that the less strong would have perished. There will have been people who were much better adapted genetically to be in certain environments. If they were living in very high altitudes, those that happened to have DNA that meant they were really good at getting oxygen out of thin air and tolerating the harsh environment there, they're going to survive better than people who don't have those genes. And as this goes on around the world over tens of thousands of years, you get concentrations of traits and people in different parts of the world who have the genetics that make them look the way they do, have the stature, have the metabolism, have the ability to cope and thrive in those environments that we see manifest today. And so that's why we get these different appearances and different groups of people who have different strengths, but they also have different weaknesses or susceptibilities to certain diseases and conditions dictated by the geography that selected for them historically. We're now beginning to mix that up again because people are moving much more around the planet. But historically, that's why we've ended up with this different distillation of different groups who we all share the same genetic code. We're all the same species, but different concentrations of different forms of genes predominate in those different populations. And that's why we see these differences.
Yeah. Now, the last question. We have time for that. Joe, play that voice note.
Morning, Clarence. This is Logan from Edenville. I'm hoping you can ask Dr. Chris Smith. I've been asking this a few times. What would he like to use the James Webb telescope to view if he was given like one entire day to, you know, choose to point it at whatever he wanted and study that for a day? I'm curious to know.
Oh, wow. What a brilliant question. That's such an important question. I don't think I'm going to answer that just off the bat. I'm going to go and think about that, because if I was given that option, I would think really carefully about that, because that's such a valuable thing to get, the chance to look with the world's best telescope at something. And you think, oh, I wouldn't want to point it at the wrong thing because I'd be making totally the wrong decision, wouldn't I? I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to take that away and I'm going to have a think about that. Next week, I'm going to come up with my suggestion as to what cosmological solution or question I'd like to probe with my day on the James Webb Space Telescope, because I think it's a brilliant, brilliant idea. It'll probably be something around exoplanets and exoplanet atmospheres. I'd say that's probably where my money's going to go, because I'm at the end of the day a life scientist. I'm interested in life. I'm interested in the question of whether there's life elsewhere in the universe, and our best prospect for finding that life is to find a planet like the Earth with an atmosphere a bit like the Earth and the key elements that we need for life: carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur. We want those elements, and we can see the compositions of distant planets' atmospheres now with the James Webb. So I think probably I'm going to say next week it's going to be looking for life signatures in the atmospheres of a planet, but which one? That's what I'm going to have a think about.
And we're going to be waiting for that response.
What would you look for? What would you use it for, Clarence?
Look, I'm absolutely fascinated. I mean, James Webb was designed to bring discoveries, and it's really proving to be such a great resource, maybe rewriting some of science in the some physics in the process as well. So it's really exciting. I wouldn't know where to look. I'm just going to be reading what you're going to find. We're going to have to wrap it up. There's news coming your way at the top of the hour. Big thank you to the Naked Scientist every Friday, just after 9:30, right here on Cape Talk.